WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. It's the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. And we've hit the halfway mark of the week over the hump day. And I'll tell you what, we're almost over the hump in November. 30 days in November, so tomorrow we'll hit the halfway point. That's hard to believe. Hard to believe. Also, tomorrow, 1 week until Thanksgiving. Coming up later on the program today, we'll be anxious to chat with some students from Nock High School who will be joining us to talk about their fall play. It's always nice to have young people here in the studio with us. And from Nock High School, we'll be anxious to chat with them, along with faculty member Jen Bronder. So that's coming up a little bit later. But as promised earlier this week, we're going to take a second listen to an interview that I did way, way back around Labor Day. In fact, it was the day after Labor Day, with John Mahler and Jim Diamond. Now, John has been in the news a lot recently. He just celebrated his 100th birthday 2 days ago on Monday, 100 years old. And they had a big birthday party for him last Friday afternoon at the Abraham VA Butler Healthcare Center. It was lovely. They had 150 people there. Had all kind of stuff going on. Music from the World War II era. John, you see, was a pilot of a Flying Fortress, a B-17 bomber in World War II. I met him last summer. Introduced myself, talked to him, and I knew that I had to have him come on the program. And I found out later from Jim Diamond, who is a former engineer at Pullman Standard, that John Mahler worked there. In fact, he's believed to be the oldest living former employee at Pullman Standard. Now, John Mahler was 99 when I did this interview a couple of months ago. He's now 100. So what a treat it was to be able to chat with him. I had people at the birthday party last Friday say they didn't hear the interview. Is there any chance of rerunning? And I thought, well, maybe we could rerun it on Thanksgiving Day. And I said, a lot of people eating Thanksgiving Day. We decided to do it today, just 2 days after his birthday. So here it was from back in early September on It's Your Turn. First of all, I want to say hello to an acquaintance of longstanding, although I wasn't had a chance to sit down and chat at length with Jim Diamond until earlier this year. Jim, good to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thank you, Dave.
We had a wonderful chat about the legacy of Pullman Standard and your plans for hoping to preserve that legacy. And then lo and behold, Jim, a few weeks back I went down to the airport, Pittsburgh Butler Regional Airport, for the Wings of Freedom tour. I wanted to see those big bombers down there. And I ran into this guy right here. His name is John Mahler. And I didn't know John. I saw him. He had a hat on that had B-17. So I went up to him and said, did you fly on this plane? And he said, yes, I did. John Mahler, nice to have you here, my friend. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming here today. And I'm so glad I was so bold to go up and shake your hand at the airport and meet you a few weeks ago. You were a pilot of a B-17, right, in World War II?
That's right. I was a pilot on a B-17.
Yeah.
With the 15th Air Force flying out of North Africa and Italy. Started my tour.
And when you flew out of North Africa, where did you go to? Where were your bombing runs to?
Well, at that time, it was support of the tank division in North Africa against, and Patton was the leader down there, and then when they got a base up in, well, during the, when Churchill and Khrushchev and Roosevelt got together, at that time, the Germans was overrunning Russia. And Khrushchev said we had to get another front opened up, and that's when they went down, and the Allies decided to go in from North Africa and then go up through the Mediterranean from the south in order to relieve the pressure on Russia. That was agreed to then.
And Germans had Rommel down there in Africa at the time, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask you how old you are, John? Because some people are going to say, this guy was a pilot of a B-17 in World War II, and he's sitting here talking to us?
It was a job that he was trained to do, and whatever they trained you for, that's what you did in the service. It was whatever you were trained for.
John Mahler, who lives in Butler, is 99 years young, right, John?
That's correct.
Soon to be 100, right?
I'm working on it.
God bless you, my friend.
I'm working on it.
God bless you. Yeah, and thank you so much for stopping in to talk with us today. I'm thrilled to have you here. I really am.
An experience to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many, and by the way, John has an interesting history with Pullman as well, and that's another reason why we're here to talk today. But a little bit about World War II. How many missions did you fly in a B-17, John?
I had 38 missions credited when the war ended.
I didn't think you had to fly that many. Was that
the only a tour of duty was 35 missions.
Uh-huh.
But when I had 35 missions in February of 45, and you could see the war was winding down over there. And when I found out what they would do, I'd go home for 30 days and retrain in 29s for the invasion of Japan. I didn't want any part of that, so I volunteered to stay over for start the second tour of duty. Mm-hmm. And depending on how long you lived, you get a promotion, so I had got another promotion then, so I only had three more missions after I had my tour in and the war ended. So
thank goodness for that.
I did. I made the right choice.
You did, yes.
I made the right choice.
Yes, you did. Let's talk a little bit about Pullman Standard and John's work there. And Jim, I'll talk with you. I know that you know John. He's one of the oldest people that still survive that worked at Pullman, right?
That's correct. He was mentioning that he is the oldest, correct? Mm-hmm. Out of the mill people, not office people, but the mill people, John's?
I knew the people in the main office, you know, slightly. I knew who they were. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any of them still living or not yet. The old-timer from the main office.
I'm still here.
I don't think there is, but I don't know for sure.
You were in the mill part.
I was in the mill.
The working end of Pullman Standard. What did you do there? Or over the course of your long career, were you pretty much everywhere in the mill?
Over the course of my time there?
Mm-hmm.
On January of 1937, I went in the mill as a rivet heater. That played out, and I went to the labor gang. I was in the labor gang till about 1939. Pullman got a contract to make shells for England.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, everything was converted from, there was no railroad cars being built, and everything went to the shell department and that, and I transferred to there and worked the labor gang getting things ready, and then finally got to be a production clerk when they started production in about 1940. And then I was there till I left for the service in 42 as a production clerk.
And then obviously after the war you went back to Pullman.
Yeah. After the war, well, I had a little bit of help. My dad was the second shift superintendent for the whole plant. He had did that in World War I, making shells. So he automatically got to be second shift superintendent. He made pretty good friends with the general manager, mm-hmm, because you talk to him every day. And when I come home from the service, I got introduced to him. And at that time, all supervisors at Pullman were required to retire at 65. But due for the war, most of them were 66, 67. And my dad took me up to see the general manager, and he asked me if I'd like to be a foreman. And I said yes for the present. I didn't want to go back, but I hate to say this. I don't hate to say it, but to me, if you come home a pilot, at that time people kind of looked up to you for something. You did a little extraordinary, it seemed. So I became a line supervisor in 1945. Got to be back with the construction department. Then in 1948, I became general foreman of the construction department. We had about 200 men. And then in 59, I became assistant general foreman of the combined two departments, construction and erection. And the erection shop foreman was 60 and getting ready to retire in 5 years. And they said I could learn that job in 5 years. It was a pretty good-sized job, a lot of responsibility for the building the cars. But so happened, that same year he died. He passed away. Well, I was under the weather. I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't ready yet. So I had a lot of help. And then I was at general foreman, construction erection, to about 64. And then Pullman began to receive a lot of orders. And we could only produce so many cars on daylight due to the electrical power. And so they put almost a full shift on the afternoon turn. And then I was put on as general superintendent on the second shift from 1965 or 66 to 1969. And then I became assistant production manager in 69. And I was that for 10 years till I retired, 79.
Yeah. And when, Jim Diamond, did the Pullman plant shut down?
82.
So that was just 3 years after John retired.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I wanted to, if my information's correct, John's dad was instrumental in the building of the shell shop buildings when they resurrected it for the Second World War.
That was for World War One.
War.
For war. And then Dad had a lot of knowledge in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was naturally put on the second shift. You know, at that time, the second shift didn't have a lot of supervision around. They worked daylight. So Dad was kind of in charge of the whole mill then for the second shift during the war.
I didn't realize until you just told us here a short time ago, John, that I knew that the Pullman plant was converted to make shells for World War II.
Yeah.
I did not realize that they did that for World War I also.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Now, Dave, if I'm telling you right, the old Bantam car, later became the Wheel Works, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That was a shop they built for World War I.
Okay.
The old Bantam car. Mm-hmm. That's where they produced shells in World War One. Yeah.
And your father then, when World War II came along,
slid right in.
He had already some experience there, so he slid right in, huh?
Wow. My father probably went into Pullman about 19. Pullman started in 1903, I think. And my dad probably went in there about 1905. He went to work down there, my father.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about the history of Pullman with Jim when he was here earlier this year, and it was 1903, right around there when
that's
it started.
When it's, yeah, that's when, what would it be, Standard Steel Car.
Mm-hmm.
It started as that in 02.
That's right. It was Standard Steel Car Company, and then it later became Pullman Standard.
In 20-something, it became Pullman Standard.
So you were there up until you signed up for the service, right, John? You weren't drafted in 1940, 41, something like that?
Well, as I say, I didn't want to enter the infantry where that was kind of rough, sleeping on the ground and K-rations, and you don't know when someone would be standing over you with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force a little better. We were back. You had a hot meal and bunks to sleep in and relatively safe.
So you decided to sign up voluntarily for the Army Air Corps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I needed to come back. I had a wife and a child at home. Mm-hmm. I needed to come back from the war.
Of course, you would be flying, you know,
yeah,
in a bomber.
That people are shooting.
With fighters all over the place.
Yeah, but flying, it was only a couple days a week. It wasn't every day. Someone looking after shooting at you.
He keeps minimizing what he did, Jim Diamond.
I know. And
I'm just sitting here in awe, quite frankly. And by the way, when you came back to Pullman, and you had been a pilot in World War II of a bomber, I would have made you a supervisor right away. You don't need to feel embarrassed about that, for goodness sakes. Obviously, you had leadership qualities. You were a pilot, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it was friendship between my dad and the general manager that got me.
You're too modest, John. You're too modest. Let me recap here for listeners who may have joined us a little bit late today. A marvelous opportunity to chat with John Mahler, who's a Butler resident, a longtime employee at Pullman Standard. As far as we know, he's the oldest guy who worked there who's still with us, and also a pilot of a B-17 bomber in World War II, for goodness sakes. Jim Diamond is also with us. I want to ask a little bit, Jim, because we chatted earlier this year when we were going over the history and the legacy of Pullman Standard, and you've been trying to organize a project with some other people who worked there about getting some banners put up. Can you give us an update on that? Where do you stand on that now?
I think we're doing okay. We're looking at various vendors. These would be banners similar to the banners up and down Main Street and all of the veterans, only mm-hmm. they would be, the banners would have pictures of Pullman machinery, equipment, really what happened in the mill when it was working. And we have some GPS locations where some of the major equipment was. I'm thinking the couple presses, they had names for them, I forget, that were huge presses. There were four men worked in them, and they worked inside the press.
Really?
They were that big. Some of them,
wow.
We had a couple 200, 2,000 ton presses. That's their capacity. And one was 2,500 tons. They were huge. So we have pictures of those, and we would like to put those banners in that area where those machines were. And then moving ahead, perhaps we could expand it. This is pretty much right now for the Transit Authority property, because we have some influence with the Transit Authority.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very, very kind to this project. And another part is that shortly within the next year or so, I don't know, depends on when the money comes, the Transit Authority will be adding a waiting room down on the property for the coaches that go back and forth to Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be able to use that waiting room for displays, and we could put in like trophy cases of things that were particular to Pullman and equipment to the men. So we're looking forward to that.
And, of course, it's right outside the Transit Authority facility there where the rail car sits right now.
Rail car sits there.
Bright yellow. And, Is that a hopper car? What is that car anyway?
That's a covered hopper. 4,750, 4,750 cubic feet. And it would haul 100 tons. And most of them weighed around 60,000 pounds.
And it hauled anything or mainly coal or what?
That car, cars were built and designed for a commodity. And the object was to get 100 tons. So some of them had larger capacities because the lading was lighter. Mm-hmm. So you wanted 100 tons. That car was, like I said, 100-ton capacity, and we built those pretty much 50 cars a day for a long time.
Wow. You talked about the giant presses before, and just so all of our listeners understand what we're talking about, and so I understand, you could put a large piece of steel in a press, and then mm-hmm. it would form that steel in a to a piece of a car.
There were two dies, a top die and a bottom die, and when they came together, when they come down on this plain flat piece, then it would deform that piece to fit the dies, and you'd have a floor sheet or whatever it was, whatever they were making. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or a side sheet or whatever.
Huh? Yeah.
Wow. Amazing equipment there.
A lot of equipment. Yeah, welders all over the place. Yeah. Hmm. We've got pictures of welders. I forget, one had like 17 heads. So there were 17 arcs going on the side. Welding side stakes down.
Were these all hand-operated, or were they robotic?
No, they were automatic.
They were automatic?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was major at that time.
I was going to say, that would be cutting edge.
That was a big deal,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It was something to see. That just come down over that sheet, and when it got to the other end, all the stakes were welded on, and you rolled another one in.
This is going to sound like a silly question, but I never got to tour that plant. Whenever a car was being put together, let's say like a hopper car, and you had a floor sheet and then the sides, was it already on trucks? Did it move down a production line, like down a set of rails, or was it moved by overhead crane at that stage? Or
I would say both. There were jigs that were on the track, and these jigs would hold a piece at an angle or wherever, so that when you put the material in and could weld it, it would lay right. You know, it would hold it in the right position.
Mm-hmm.
Once it was a little past that, they had rollovers. And what they would do is at both ends of the car, they would clamp into it, and they would roll what was there over so the guys could weld downhand.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then it would move to another position, and they'd roll it the other way or whatever. Yeah, they were, it was crazy. These half cars are going down and rolling over. It was amazing. Amazing.
And when the welds were completed on that side, it would roll back over. Yeah. So then eventually the assembled car would be put on trucks, right?
Yeah.
Wheels.
Yeah, shop trucks. Once it was to the point where it was solid, stable, then it was on shop trucks, and they'd continue to add pieces and do whatever.
Was it painted before it was put on the actual wheels that it would roll out on?
They had shop trucks because the car would run through the shot blast,
mm-hmm.
and that would affect the bearings. So those the real trucks, the road trucks, were removed, shop trucks put on, then they would roll through the shot and paint with shop trucks. And when it came out the other end, they'd put the road trucks back on, and it would go out.
What a complex process, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And you were turning out 50 of those a day.
Yeah. And you got to remember that somebody somewhere was building parts for tomorrow, 50 of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cutting, shearing, bending. That was one of the pictures. Those are some of the pictures that we have, is just the stacks of material just to keep that flowing.
Wow. Talking about Pullman Standard, we're talking with John Mahler and Jim Diamond. We need to take a break, so let's do that. We'll come back and talk a little bit more with our guests here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back. Realize how close we are to the holidays. A week from tomorrow is Thanksgiving. And you know what happened? I mean, it's just like that, you know, it's Hanukkah, it's Christmas, it's New Year's. If you're cleaning in advance of the holidays and you end up with a lot of stuff you want to get rid of, please consider donating to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store. They can really use your stuff, whether it's clothing or shoes or furniture or household items. They'll sell it at the thrift store. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store is located in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8, just south of Butler. And every penny of the proceeds from the operation of that thrift store stay in Butler County to help support the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank and their client aid program. So, guys, think about it. If you're cleaning or moving or downsizing, they're open Monday through Saturday, 6 days a week, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. And remember, if you got a lot of stuff, like a lot of furniture or big stuff, call them. They'll come pick it up in the truck. Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. We stand tallest when we stoop to help others. They do wonderful things to help the needy and the less fortunate. If you're joining us a little bit late, we're talking about the wonderful history of Pullman Standard and also the wonderful personal history of John Mahler, a Butler man, pilot of a flying fortress in World War II. He just celebrated his 100th birthday a couple of days ago. We're taking a second listen to an interview that I did with John and with Jim back around Labor Day. Let's get back to that interview. Back, folks. Really enjoying conversation here today with Jim Diamond, who was a longtime engineer at Pullman Standard, and also John Mahler is here. John worked in a variety of different capacities at Pullman Standard, both before and after World War II. We were talking during the break, John, about people that either had nobody that worked at Pullman or maybe didn't live here then, really have no idea how busy this plant was. You were telling me that you turned out 50 cars a day, which meant, John, you had to take in 60 carloads of steel every day just to make the new cars, right?
That's good proportion, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
So the steel came in by rail.
Railroad.
You would unload it and start to shape it and weld it and everything else, and then it would go out as a new rail car. But meanwhile, you were getting another 50 loads of steel in for the next day. Wow.
Now, you have to remember, too, it wasn't like an automobile plant. You just built cars. You built cars to the railroad's specifications. All steel wasn't the same.
Uh-huh.
All steel wasn't the same. Some was high strength, some was tri-10, some was just regular steel. Well, they paid extra for the tri-10 or other steel that was a better grade, so that all had to be separated to the order. There was no mixing it up. So they had to be each. You might be building three different railroads at a time. Mm-hmm. But that didn't mean that you could just use any floor sheet or any side sheet.
That's right.
It had to be that railroad specification.
And who were the railroads that Pullman built cars for, like B&O and B&LE and lines like this? Or even
Santa Fe? Union Pacific.
Wow. Those are both Santa out Fe, west.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember we got, what was it, 2,500 order?
What?
2,500 car order from Union Pacific?
Oh, yeah. Santa Fe ordered every year.
Yeah.
Santa Fe ordered cars from us every year, as much as they had in their budget, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Big numbers.
These railroads would take, each car was built as what they call it, a series. Well, that whole series then, when they figured it had 300,000-400,000 mile on, they would bring them in to their shop and renovate them,
mm-hmm.
put new axles in them, or mm-hmm. the floors would be eaten out, put all new floors. They didn't just take one car. They'd take that series in and rebuild them. and then they wouldn't last another 300,000 or 400,000, but maybe they'd go half of that distance,
mm-hmm.
and then they would sell them to some little railroad or scrap them and order new ones. But when the covered hopper come in for grain or hauling grain and that, rather than a boxcar, you could unload it quick and unload it automatically.
Yeah.
That became very popular. And the cars were standardized to some extent, except for a few exceptions that the railroad would request. Some had round hatches on top. Some had trough hatches on top. Some had the whole bottom drop out for coal. Some had chutes for coal. Just whatever they ordered. Each one was different. It wasn't like you go buy a car, they're automobile, they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
Each order was different.
Yeah.
Something was different about it.
Now, would you build...
And then they sent, these railroads would send inspectors in, and you had to decide, you satisfy that inspector before he would sign for the car each day. If it wasn't right, he would sign for the car. You know, it had to be to their specification.
Mm-hmm. I'm just... Boggles my mind to think of what a busy place that was every day. When workers going in and out, and of course you had a whole building of office staff.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only building that still remains there, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Boy, it'd be nice if that could be saved, wouldn't it, Jim?
It would be dynamite, but I don't know what condition it's like inside.
I pass it every day, and you hope that it... I mean, it doesn't take long, even for a building like that, to deteriorate if it's not being used.
More and more windows are out.
That's what I notice when I go by. Yeah. And then, you know, you got to figure weather gets in, and maybe birds get in, or who knows what.
Yeah. Union Pacific, I remember, they had the car has a center sill, and it runs end to end, and the typical one was 41.2 pounds. That was a Z. And you put two of those together, welded them up, that was the center sill. Union Pacific wanted 51 point something pounds, so that was 100 pounds per foot. And I asked the inspector one time, everybody gets 41, why do you want this? He said, because we're Union Pacific. Just like that, that's what we want. Yeah. And that's what John was saying. They wanted something special. This was theirs.
Did Pullman have salespeople that went out and you know, made sales calls, or did generally the railroads who knew of your reputation come to you by themselves and say, we need more cars?
Our salespeople were mostly in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then the last, since about 70, we had a plant in Bessemer, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we used to build box cars, flat cars, trailer train cars, coal cars. But then in about 70, we had a plant in Bessemer, and we kind of standardized the car to a certain extent. Butler took the coal car and the covered hopper car and all box cars and trailer train cars for hauling trailers and automobiles. They went to Bessemer. So we kind of, at the last few years, we standardized in coal cars and covered hopper cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was more or less our standard.
Pullman's headquarters was in Chicago, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Were they still making, you might not know this, Jim Diamond, were they still making the sleeper cars, the famous Pullman sleeper cars at some of their plants?
That was mostly made in Worcester, Massachusetts. I'm going to guess no. Michigan City took over a lot of the, like, dome cars, not the sleepers so much, but the dome cars for people to travel cross-country. I think the typical Pullman standard sleeper, I don't think they were being built then. I don't know. But those big dome cars were gorgeous. And Michigan City, another plant like Bessemer, that was there. That's what they did. That's what they built.
I think I may have told you this story quite a few years ago now. I was in Paris, And I was at a train station in Paris. Had a Eurail pass. You can buy them in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and ride any train in Europe. Great way to travel around Europe, by the way. And I'm waiting at this train station, Gare du Nord or something like that, and this train pulls in. It wasn't mine. Trains going in and out all the time. Stops right in front of me, and there's five Pullman cars there.
Oh, my.
So here I am on a platform in Paris, and I'm looking down Pullman. Yeah. I thought, wow, what a coincidence, you know? Now, these would have been, they weren't dumb cars, but they were passenger cars. Yeah. You know, obviously, they were used for passenger trains in Europe, but it was really something to look down and see that. You know, I felt like I was home already.
Yeah, they were beautiful. Those cars, woodwork was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Dining cars. We made a couple trips from Pittsburgh to Chicago, Chicago to St. Louis, and stayed overnight on the train. And it was fun to do, you know.
Don't you wish we still had the trains running here in America like we used to?
Yeah.
Wow, we could really use them today. We could really use them. Cut down on the traffic problems and everything. My, my. Not too many trains run in the U.S. anymore.
No. Other than freight, no.
Yeah. Now, there's a little bit of passenger travel yeah. on Amtrak or something like yeah. that, but nothing like it used to be, huh?
Canada has VIA. It's very well accepted. Runs right along like our border mm-hmm. through the Rockies. But we don't have that.
I've heard that's a fantastic trip, by
it
the way.
It is. Really nice.
Trans-Canada yeah. thing, yeah. Who knows? Of course, if we still had trains, maybe we'd still have Pullman here, too. Huh?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It still amazes me that Butler was able to take a hit like that and survive. When you think of how many jobs were lost just like that.
Right now.
When Pullman, I mean, yeah, you yeah. snap your fingers and they were gone. Pullman still had a whole lot of employees whenever the plant suddenly closed.
I don't know. I would guess around 2,500 people working when they closed.
On what?
When Pullman closed. How many people?
I wasn't there, but we averaged around 1,800 or 2,000 mm-hmm. when we was building 53 cars a day.
Yeah.
That was down in the shop.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, workers. Yeah.
And so still more on the office
everything.
Staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was, by the way, about 30 years ago now that Pullman closed, 80, right?
82, whatever that is.
92, that's 36 years ago. Wow. Long time ago, huh?
Yeah, long time.
Yeah. Did the folks who were at Pullman at the time, did they sense that was coming, or was that a lightning bolt when it suddenly closed?
I think people who were aware accepted that it was closing, and there were many, I think, who might even still be waiting for it to open. You know, it was pretty obvious that it was no orders. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And not buying anything. Purchasing was done. Those kinds of things. It was pretty clear. But one of the things, when Butler closed, one of the problems was that we were so big, physically so big. You had a press, and you had, I don't know how much area around that press for material coming in, going out. Greenville, they built like 8 cars a day. Small car builders survived because they didn't need the 100 car, 200 car order to stay in business. They could get along with 50 cars because they were building 8 a day.
Mm-hmm.
The shop was smaller because of that. It was easier to move material. You didn't have to, and in Butler, the plant was so big, material was everywhere. We couldn't really profitably do an 8 car a day operation. So that was another thing that was against Butler.
Was Butler one of the largest of the Pullman plants at the time?
Butler claimed to be the largest in the world.
Wow.
For some years, huh?
That's right.
Yeah.
Are there any Pullman plants still operating today?
There are no Pullman anythings today. Mm-hmm. All their shops are done, closed.
So Massachusetts Bessemer, Alabama. Where was Greenville? Greenville, PA?
PA.
Oh, really? I didn't realize there was another one that close.
Yeah.
That's in Mercer County.
Yeah, they had a nice little shop up there. I'm trying to think who else was local. Oh, Cincinnati had Ortner, which was a little smaller. I think they didn't have the capacity that Butler had, but they were the same. I mean, all these places just went down. Mm. That was it.
Well, as we were mentioning a few minutes ago, rail travel died out, and rail shipping died out to some extent. Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it must have been like here in Butler in the heyday. We have trains coming and going here like crazy, wouldn't we, every day?
Yeah. Yeah, down like where Osterlings is, the Pennsylvania Railroad.
Yeah.
They had a big, building there where they had a warehouse type thing. They were there. B&O was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have an occasional train that goes through,
mm-hmm.
but it must have been a madhouse back in the heyday.
Yeah.
Not only with Pullman, but with Armco as well.
Sure.
They had a lot of coming and going by rail.
Yeah. Yeah. Dave.
Yes, John.
On the negative side,
mm-hmm.
of course, we were old-time car builders. They called it the dumb car knockers, is what we were called. But we could build cars. But from my point, the way I saw it, in 75, we got new management in Chicago. That was our headquarters. And they thought different. Pullman was a conglomerate. Pullman was on the 500 stocks of the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes.
The top 500.
Yeah.
But we were going to build a plant in North Africa. We were going to build 100 cars a day at Butler instead of the 53. Mm-hmm. Remember the paint shop?
Yeah.
Spent $1 million renovating the paint shop. But this new regime had different ideas. They had the modern. You know, this, we're going to do this, we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they let the basic go by the wayside, put it that way as I see it. There's another word for it, where they let it go,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to use it. But they let it go by the wayside. And it was just a matter of, I'd say it was a new modern management. The way I feel about it, I was there for, no, I'm not bragging what I knew, but I was there for 38 years, and then they had industrial engineers come in and went to school for 6 months and says, you're doing it wrong. Well, and the management says you go along with them.
Yeah.
I talked to the manager and said, what you're doing is wrong. Well, I can't do anything about it. The orders are from Chicago. I contributed a lot of why Pullman shut down was Chicago. It wasn't us. We was making money. We made the company the money. You know that.
I agree.
We made it for them. But the mismanagement, I think, out there, new ideas.
I can remember there were two guys that we called Steel Chasers. Their name escapes me. And when this came through that John had, there were these two guys. If you needed a certain piece of steel, you went to him. He pulled out of his back pocket. It's over in aisle 4. They had, I don't know how many industrial engineers come in. Computers all over the place. They couldn't find anything.
Well, they would get them. They did the scheduling and everything. He took the scheduling off us and everything. Well, I was kind of in charge of all production, and it came to the place they'd make a mistake. Well, we'll have to close it down for a day or two. We don't get the parts made. And I used to say, I can get them out of it. I'll just work double shift, and I can get them out of it. You know, the trouble. Called them in. My boss used to say, let them get stuck. Well, that was Pullman. That was my company. So I'd work double shift or something, get Coleman in on Saturday and Sunday, and get them ready to go. We didn't lose any production. But it didn't worry them that you'd shut down for a day or two. You know, it was just management that I didn't believe in, put it that way. Maybe I was wrong, but I didn't believe in it.
Let me ask you something about, as I said, I never got a chance to tour that plant. With all of these huge presses and big loads of steel coming in, it must have been dangerous work.
Yes, it was.
I'm sure there were people that got seriously hurt there.
Yeah, they did.
It would have to be.
Yeah, some did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, some did. But we had, of course, Pennsylvania had safety laws, too, and they come in and inspected us every so often and would write us up for something. Well, every week we had a safety tour, too, with one of the safety men from the, up in the main office to make sure. Those men were just, every man in there was one was as valuable as the other.
Yeah.
Didn't make any difference. You had to protect them all.
Was there an overnight shift of workers at Pullman? Was the plant operating all night long?
My recollection is the sides were night turn, weren't they? They built sides up where Kmart was. Up in that area, they built sides because they couldn't build enough sides in two shifts to maintain the main mill's production.
Mm-hmm.
So they would run main mill for two shifts, and the third shift was for sides. They ran all day, 24 hours, I'm pretty sure.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where did the wheels come from for the cars that were built? Because the wheels weren't made here, right?
No. No. Oh, they were, I remember, Sumitomo.
The what?
Wheels. The purchasing would just, I think, price them, buy them, come in, and then we had a wheel and axle shop, and they would take the wheels, and the wheels were pressed onto the axles, so they would prepare the hole in the wheel to accept the axle, because there had to be some interference to keep it on. It wasn't welded or anything on. It was pressed on. Was interference fit. So they did all that, and then they assembled the truck. Side frames, bearings, pressed the bearings on. Yeah, they did all that.
And then they would set the completed car down on top of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, they bought springs, all that stuff. They bought brake, shoes, all those little pieces that went into that. They bought and put them in.
What an incredibly complex operation that plant was, huh?
Yes, it was.
Wow.
One of the things you was mentioned, for years we had the old, what they called friction bearing on the wheels. Well, you had a box on each end that you filled with waste, then poured oil in it. You've seen them on the old...
Mm-hmm. Waste boxes.
Well, then that went out in about late 60 sometime. And they went to roller bearings. A company over in Ohio made them all, most of them.
Hyatt was a big name.
Yeah, anyhow. But then when you came to roller bearings, when you was welding cars, you couldn't have the truck under the car that you was welding on because a spark might spark on that roller bearing. So then that would cause that roller bearing to be bad. Mm-hmm. And then... Actually, if a bearing like that, over 1,000 miles, that big 6x6 axle, it would cut it in two. So anytime you did any welding, you had to get that truck back out from under that car so that a spark didn't adventurally go through that roller bearing. You know, so there'd be a flaw in it and then it would grind itself away.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Even a small flaw would eventually eat away because those things are spinning around, very, very fast. Yeah. Wow. I need to take one more break here, and just a couple of minutes while I've left to chat with our guests. What a wonderful chat it's been here today. It's that time of the year. Sniffles, coughing, chills, everything else that comes with cold and flu season. At Institute Hill Pharmacy, they want to get you feeling better as soon as possible. You'll have your prescription filled in minutes and be on your way to feeling better. Because who wants to be sick around the holidays? Stop by Institute Hill Pharmacy at 937 East Jefferson Street. Call 285-3693 or find them on Facebook. And don't forget, they have great 99-cent greeting cards, retailer gift cards, and seasonal gifts for the holidays. Institute Hill Pharmacy and Old
old-fashioned pharmacy just the way you remember.
We have a caller with a little bit of information. Maybe you can put on those headphones there, guys, so you can hear the caller. We'll help you on here. That's okay. Take your time. Okay, caller, I'm getting my guests hooked up to hear you. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi. Well, I've got a little old history for you of Pullman.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather, Oscar Otterson, was the engineer, one of the engineers at Pullman. And
Jim
Diamond's
chuckling here. I think you know Otto? You knew him?
Of him.
You knew of him? Okay. Go ahead, Paul.
Oscar.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Oscar?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was Oscar Otterson.
Okay.
He actually became, they made him an honorary colonel so he could fly over Germany in the bomb sites to see what kind of shells that Pullman needed to make.
How about that, huh?
Gee.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that wild? And he lived in Meridian. He would take the little trolley car into Pullman every day to work.
Hmm.
I know him well.
Oh.
Oscar.
I know Oscar well. Yes, I did.
Wow.
That's great.
How about that?
And his son, Henry, was a draftsman there, too.
Henry.
And inspector. So he actually retired, and then they brought him back. At Pullman. So we have a lot of family history in the Otterson family for Pullman.
Hey, I appreciate you sharing with us. You brought a big smile to John's face.
Can I say something about Otter?
Sure, John, go ahead.
I can remember one time coming from church. We sat on Main Street. I was behind Otto, and the light was green, and he sat there. The light turned red, and off Oscar took. So I don't know whether he was colorblind or not, but I remember that like yesterday.
That's a wonderful story.
Well, did you know his daughter, Ruth? Did you know his daughter, Ruth Otterson?
No, I didn't know any of his family. Okay. I just knew him.
Okay, that was my mother. She just passed at almost 98 years old.
Oh, okay.
Well, hey, thanks for taking the time to call. It was really great to hear from you.
Thank you. Well, I hope we get to restore the Pullman building because that has a lot of memories.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks. Great to hear from her. And part of your work, Jim Diamond, is to make sure that this wonderful legacy, this history of this plant is not lost. Because all of a sudden now it's 35 years since it closed, and we have to keep the memory alive, don't we?
We have to do that. People are just indifferent, or I don't know. And what we're hoping is that we can demonstrate what went on there with these banners and programs like this. I wanted to tell the lady who called, when I started in plant engineering, and Oscar at one time, I think, was the plant engineer. And the drawings were 00 dash and a number. And so one time I said to my boss at that time, Al Snyder, what's 00 for? He said, Oscar Otterson. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm sure that lady is still listening there. John, I want to ask you a couple of more questions about your service in the Army Air Corps in World War II. You were a pilot of a B-17. Were you ever scared when you were up there?
Dave, yes and no. When things were at the worst, I was too busy to be scared. Mm-hmm. I had too many things on my mind. And when it was all over, you come off the target and was almost home, and then you could sit down and it's over. We made another one.
Wow.
Yeah. There's something happened every time on every mission. You know, something happened.
I didn't realize until I visited the Wings of Freedom tour at the Pittsburgh-Butler Regional Airport a few weeks back. It was back in August. I didn't realize how compact it was inside a B-17. That's a big airplane, folks.
Yeah,
it's got four engines. It's a huge wingspan. But when you get up inside it,
there's not all that much room to move around.
No.
It's a pretty narrow tube, you know, the fuselage. And you had 10 crew in there, right?
Ten
guys?
10 fellas. Ten or 11.
Yeah.
Sometimes we had a radar jammer with us. He was the 11th man. But we did. You're just one of those in each squadron. He could be in your airplane. He could be in another one.
And even to get into the darn thing was pretty tough. And to get up that little hatch underneath there and kind of haul yourself up in, didn't you?
We were young then.
Yeah, well, thank goodness they had a ladder so I could get in it. I would never have been able to swing myself up in there. And then you had to climb up into the cockpit, and I walked back through, and the place where the radio man sat, just a tiny little spot. And then you had to walk back past the where the bombs were stored to get to the gunner positions.
That's right.
And then the tail gunner.
Tail gunner.
Who was squeezed in. I can't imagine how a guy could get back in there.
I know. It seems impossible. It happened.
Yeah.
Once you sit down in the pilot seat, though, at 6 o'clock in the morning, you got out of it about 3. You didn't get out of it for any reason.
Wow.
You sit there for that long. I can remember calling out, and you'd be so stiff that you couldn't stand up for 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You couldn't stand up. You were stooped over.
Mm-hmm.
Just so, sitting there so long.
It was cold up there, too, right? Those planes weren't pressurized.
No. Pressurized or heated, no. Mm-hmm. 65 below zero, lots of time.
And you needed oxygen, of course, when you were up there.
But on oxygen, pilot and co-pilot on oxygen about 10,000 feet. The rest of the crew that wasn't doing any exertion on about 13. You have to conserve your oxygen mm-hmm. as much as you could.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, little story, our radio operator at one time, I thought the oxygen was going down pretty fast. And I told the co-pilot, check out, see if anything's wrong back there. And a couple of minutes, he said, we got a problem. And I said, what's that? He said, the radio operator forgot his oxygen mask. He's driven straight off the tank. And I said, my, that can't be. That can't be. And you didn't. When we took off in the morning, the orders were, you will put the bombs on the target. You will bring 9 other men and yourself back home if you can. And so you will save that airplane if possible. So if something like the other radio man, I told him, you might have to jump. He couldn't believe what I told him. But there was no leaving formation or I'd have been in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one man jeopardized the 9 others. But we got through it, and of course she was to report every incident that went on that wasn't normal at a debriefing. But I got the crew together and I said, this episode is forgotten. We never want to hear another word. We're not going to get him in trouble. You know, I mean, maybe he'll learn his lesson. And so it was kind of forgotten. But, you know, it was one of your buddies. You didn't want to report him.
How many planes were in a formation when you went out on a bombing mission, John?
There was many groups mm-hmm. in an Air Force. A group had 4 squadrons of different airplanes, B-17, B-24s, B-25s, fighter plane. Each squadron, depending on what they called a maximum effort or something, they tell you how many airplanes to put up. And mostly in a squadron, there was, from 10 to 15
okay. In
each squadron. So a group would have maybe 60 airplanes out of that group.
And you had to stay in formation the whole time?
All the time.
Yeah.
Close formation. You could almost identify in the airplane that you was flying off of. Close formation. The Germans like to come straight at you and break you up, like we used to say, play chicken,
mm-hmm.
and then they get you individually, then you was done. But so you had to play close so they couldn't get through. Because they come straight at you and try to break you up.
John, I'm speaking for all of our listeners here today who have been with us when I thank you for your service in World War II.
Appreciate you saying that.
I thank you for your service.
Appreciate you saying that.
This is a man who was a pilot of a B-17, 38 bombing missions in North Africa. John Mahler. I'm so glad I met you at the airport, and I'm so glad that you came in to talk to us today.
Thank you.
I really am.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you, my friend. Jim Diamond, thanks for bringing this guy in
here
today.
Thank you, Dave.
And keep us posted on the Pullman Legacy Project.
I will do that.
Anytime you have an update for us, you let us know, and we'll make sure that everyone's aware of it.
Thank you. I will.
Yeah. Nice to see you.
It's good to see you.
Olivia from Washington. Laid off and trying to keep our little kids from realizing that Mommy and Daddy haven't eaten in a while.
Roger from California. I'm grateful we could afford our son's surgery. I'm nervous that now we can't really afford food.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Donna from Louisiana. The storm just hit, and we went from donating to the food bank to needing it.
Keisha from South Carolina. I've been skipping meals so my two kids can eat, but filling up on water doesn't really work.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. It's the holiday season, and you're buying gifts for everyone, but not everyone lives around here anymore. So you've got to ship those gifts, and you want a local, reliable shipping company that you can trust to get that package to your loved ones. We suggest Going Postal in Butler. Going Postal, just off Newcastle Road. They'll find a way to ship just about anything. Simple, too. Just take the gift up. They pack it. They ship it. And if you want to get stocking stuffers like lottery tickets or Christmas cards, they've got those, too. They're just off Newcastle Road, right in between Villa Grande and King's Restaurant. Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping store.
Welcome back, good friends. I tell you, I'm so glad we were able to replay that interview that I did with John Mahler and Jim Diamond. I'd forgotten how fascinating it was to hear that. I think John's going to go on the record books as the oldest guest we've ever had here on It's Your Turn. And isn't that wonderful? 100 years old visiting with us. Well, we move on. We have guests with us live in the studio now, and it's wonderful to have several students from Nock High School here to talk about their fall play. We'll meet them in just a second. We want to say hello to faculty member and play director, Jen Bronder. Jen, good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for bringing the young adults into the studio for us. We'll say hello to them. Mackenzie Mead is here. Mackenzie, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Nice to meet you. Also, Amelia Lyon. Hi, Amelia.
Hi.
And also, Sam Thinnes.
Hello.
Sam, good to see you as well.
Nice to see you, too.
Jen, the play is, I can remember this like it was yesterday. And believe me, it wasn't yesterday when my brother and I and the neighborhood kids all played this game, you know? Mm-hmm. Okay, I say it was Colonel Mustard in the conservatory with a lead pipe. It's Clue, the board game, right?
It is, yes.
I did not know it had been made into a play.
It had, and the play actually is very recent. It just premiered last summer at the Bucks County Playhouse.
Oh, okay.
And so
that's in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
Outside of Philadelphia, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Sally Struthers was in that cast.
Oh.
So, yeah.
From All in the Family.
From All in the Family.
Wow. Now, let me see. What would she have been? Could have been Miss Scarlet. She's a little too old for that. Maybe Mrs. Well, don't tell me I'm forgetting the names already. Mrs. White? No.
I think, yes.
Mrs.
White?
Is that,
Mrs. White?
Was that a character?
Mm-hmm.
I remember Colonel Mustard.
Mm-hmm.
Goofy name. Well, they were all goofy names, really, to begin with. I also understand, I missed this somewhere along the line, too, it had been made into a film at some point, right?
It had, 1985. Tim Curry was in it, Madeline Kahn, Michael McKean. So
Madeline Kahn, the late Madeline Kahn. Mm-hmm. Any of you young adults remember Madeline Kahn?
No.
She has since died, but a funny, 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 funny lady. Young Frankenstein. Yeah. Next time you see that movie, that's Madeline Kahn. Well, let's talk to our students here. Are all of you at Nock High School, right?
Yes. Yeah.
This is a high school play, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And we don't need any young kids in here like The Wizard of Oz or something
No.
like that.
No.
Mackenzie, what part do you play?
I play Miss Scarlet.
Miss Scarlet. I remember that character, yes. What about you, Amelia?
Well, he's not from the game, but I play Wadsworth, the butler.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't have remembered that because he's not in the board game, huh?
No.
What about you, Sam?
I play Mr. Green.
Mr. Green. I forgot about that character, mm-hmm. too. Yeah. So that leaves Colonel Mustard.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. White.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's about it.
Mrs. Peacock.
Oh, I forgot about Mrs. Peacock. Yeah. How could I have forgotten Mrs. Peacock?
And Professor Plum.
One of the more unusual names.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, for people who never played this game, and I can't believe there are too many people out there, this was about, you know, solving murders. But the play itself, it's a comedy, right?
It is. And there are several murders, and a lot of these characters may have done them. Professor Plum, Mrs. Peacock, Miss Scarlet, Mr. Green. Mm-hmm. They may have all committed these murders, but it's not until the end until you find out how it worked out.
Well, that's the way you want a good mystery comedy, huh?
That's right.
Is there a lot of on-stage action where people are stumbling over each other and running out of doors and that sort of thing?
Mackenzie's
shaking her head, yes.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So this almost is kind of like a farce then. I love farces, by the way. Yeah. But over-the-top comedy, right? Yeah. So what's the basic plot here, Mackenzie? I can remember playing the board game, but how is this adapted into a play? What happens?
Well, it all starts as a dinner theater where all the guests arrive at this beautiful house, but they're not really sure while they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, things just, they go wrong for the guests, and they're trying to solve, stuff goes missing, and it's a lot of confusion, and then it's all drawn together at the end.
Who, Amelia, who throws the dinner party? Who's the perpetrator of this big soiree?
Well, it all starts with a certain M. Body who invites everyone to the house for a certain confidential reason.
M. Body?
Yes.
Like the initial M. Body?
Mm-hmm.
Mysterious already, huh? Yeah.
Tell me, M stands for, maybe.
Tell me a little bit, Sam, about your character. In the board game, it was just, it was a person.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming, Sam, that your part is fleshed out a little bit in the play?
Yeah, my character is mainly just clumsy, very nervous, and like has like sweaty palms all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And just scared of everything.
How do you show that on stage? Sweaty palms.
Normally I carry a handkerchief.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Is everybody, Mackenzie, on stage at the same time, or do people come in and out depending on the situation?
There are a few characters that come in and out, but for the majority of the play, like, everybody is on stage at the whole time.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an ensemble piece, huh? Mm-hmm. Jen, that makes it a little bit more difficult to direct, right? Because you got to move a lot of bodies around, make sure nobody's being blocked or anything like that.
It is. It's a lot of making sure people aren't blocked. But I think one of the things that works well about the ensemble is that this cast is very close and they work so well together that it brings that energy up that's needed to make a farce move quickly and with some rhythm. That mm-hmm. makes sense. So it helps to have a lot of people. Sometimes.
Very important. I've done some farce, and Amelia, you know this. Timing is everything. You can pick up a script of a play that's a farce and laugh your head off, but if you see it done on stage and the timing isn't there, it's just the audience goes dead. That's
absolutely,
when you start to
yeah.
panic, and I'm like, why aren't they laughing? This is supposed to be funny. So it takes a lot of rehearsal, doesn't it?
Yes, lots of rehearsal. We're there for the past couple of weeks. We've been there almost every night and just working our butts off for several hours and getting there as early as we possibly can, staying there as late as we possibly can, trying to make sure everything flows and works together.
Have you had any conflict with the sports teams in trying to do the fall play? You've had some great success in sport. Hey, before I forget, how about the Knock Girls volleyball team?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Defending state champions and very difficult to even make the playoffs the next year. They went all the way to the state semifinals before losing a heartbreaker last night. Mm-hmm. If they'd have won last night, they'd have played for the state championship again.
Yeah.
That's practically unheard of. So that deserves special mention, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Coach Geist and Coach Bolt are just amazing, and they do such a wonderful job with that program. We're so proud of them and excited for them.
Yeah. You ought to have a special note at intermission in your play. Have them stand up or something if they're in the audience. Yeah. Is there an intermission, by the way? I've never seen that.
There is. There is an intermission,
okay.
Yes.
Well, let me talk a little bit. Sam, just slide that mic over just a little bit closer for you there. That's grand. Now, I remember from the board game, which I probably haven't played in, I don't know, 30 years or something like that, maybe longer, they had these the instruments of crime, which you had to guess. Let me think about Clue. You had to guess three things. You had to guess who did it. You had to guess the instrument of crime, and you had to guess where it happened. And if you got any of those wrong, I'm sorry, you're done, and it's somebody else's turn. Do we still have the rope, the lead pipe, the candlestick, all that jazz?
Yeah, we still have it.
Sam?
Yes, we do.
Do you have those physical props? Are they around in the room?
Yeah, we actually carry them around, not the whole show, but until they're used, yes.
I'm somewhat mystified as to how this all shakes down, because as I remember from the game, I don't know, you got to draw a card and it would Amelia's shaking her head. You drew a card and that would tell you what it wasn't. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you got a card for the lead pipe, then you knew it wasn't the lead pipe. So it was kind of a, what do they call that? The process of induction or deduction or something like that. Yeah. Okay. How does that happen in the show, Sam? You're not drawing cards or anything like that.
No, we're not drawing cards, but it's basically at the start of the play where you're just given a weapon, and then that person usually uses that weapon.
I see.
That they've received.
Well, say no more about that. Amelia, what's this extra character that's not in the board game that you mentioned earlier?
All right, well, I play Wadsworth, and he's kind of like your driving force. So all of these guests are here, but they don't know why. And so he's the one who has to, like, start the ball rolling and be like, okay, guys, this is what we're doing now. And, like, he keeps everyone moving and keeps the pace going. He almost is like the narrator, but not quite.
Mm-hmm. Is he an emissary of this M-body guy, this mysterious character?
He absolutely
is. Listen to me,
is.
I'm talking like this is a mystery.
Yeah, he's M-body's butler.
Oh, okay. Well, that brings up that whole classic question. Did the butler do it? Well, I guess we'll have to find out.
My lips are sealed.
Show times and show dates, Jen.
This Friday and Saturday, 7:30.
Senior High School Auditorium. I guess it's just Knock High School, isn't it? Yeah, Knock High. Well, let me talk a little bit with our guests here about their schoolwork. I'll talk with you first, Mackenzie Mead. Are you senior, junior?
I'm a senior this year.
Senior? Graduation time looms, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got the holiday break, and then you'll have about a half a year of high school left.
Yep.
Wow. What are you going to do after that? Do you have any idea?
Well, I did recently get accepted into the Cooks Honors College at IUP.
Oh, wow. Terrific. Now, wait a minute. For me, this is rarefied air. I think one time in my entire collegiate career did I make the dean's list. So you got into honors college?
Yes, I did.
So tell me about that. What's that mean? Obviously, your grades are terrific, right?
Well, it's just kind of like AP college where the classes are going to be more secluded. Kind of had to have certain requirements to get into the honors college. So it's still IUP, just with kind of the people the same level as I am.
Do you have to have like a 4.0 or a 4.2 or something like that?
No, but I do.
But you're pretty close to that.
Yeah.
I thought you would be, yeah. And it's called Cook's?
It's the Cook's Honors College at IUP.
I see. Is there any scholarship help available by you qualifying for that?
Yeah, I've gotten a couple.
Mm-hmm. You have to keep the grades up, though, right?
Yes, I do.
In order to keep the scholarship money coming in. So I'm telling you right now, keep studying.
Will do.
When you get there. What are you going to major in?
Communications media.
Wonderful. What's your dream job? Are you going to be a writer or a publicist?
I'm not really sure what my dream job is, just something in the communications field.
You know, communications is changing so rapidly now with the digital age and everything, so you might end up with an internet job of some sort.
And I'd be perfectly fine with that.
Yeah. Well, good for you. That's terrific. And congratulations on gaining entrance already.
Thank you.
Let's move over to Amelia here. Amelia Lyon. What class are you? Are you a senior as well?
I'm a senior, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what are your future plans, or are you still kind of in limbo here?
I am much less prepared than Mackenzie over here. I am still kind of in the process of applying to colleges right now, and then we'll hope I get accepted at least.
But. You know, I've talked to some other young adults in recent years, and it seems like the whole thing of being accepted comes much later than it used to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can remember, but I wasn't in honors college, believe me, but I can remember getting acceptance letters from the schools that I applied to in like March, you know, February, March. And it seems like it's much later now for most kids these days.
Mm-hmm. I think finances play a lot into that too.
Yeah.
Like student deciding what school they can afford to go to, using loans and scholarships and things like that.
So you're not behind the times here, Amelia.
No, not quite yet.
No. Do you have any idea where you might like to go to school?
I want to go somewhere in like the Pittsburgh area. Point Park is probably the one that I'm really interested in
right now. Are you looking at some sort of a fine arts major?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think English would be my ideal. I'm not sure the exact career yet, though.
Mm-hmm. English. Are you good in English?
I like to think so.
Yeah. So if you majored in English, would you teach or would you do research or what would you do?
I'd probably want to do something that lets me write a lot more. That's been a passion of mine for quite some time. I enjoy writing and being able to work more with my creative side.
Interesting. Yeah. So what do you write? Poetry? Short stories?
I work more with, stories and fiction.
Hmm. I didn't do that when I was in high school. Did you, Jen?
I did.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm the oddball here. Maybe I'm Professor Plum in this whole outfit. I'm not sure. Let me push that microphone over there to Sam and talk to him a little bit. Sam, are you a senior as well?
No, I'm a junior.
Okay. So you're the young one in this crowd here, huh?
Yes, I am.
Have you thought anything at all about post-high school? I mean, you're only a junior, so, you know.
I mean, I was thinking about science, but science really isn't going so well for me this year, so I might change it here and there, but, yeah.
It's a good field.
Yeah.
You do have to be kind of on top of your game, though, if you're going to succeed in the science field. Yeah. Well, whatever you decide to do, good luck to you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. You would hope for a higher education?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah. We're talking with the three students from Nock High School. They're cast members all in the upcoming Nock High production of Clue. The Clue on Stage, I guess, is the title, right? Not to be confused with the board game. Is that still around? I mean, if you go to the toy store or whatever, Amazon, can you still find Clue, Mackenzie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Have you guys all played?
Yeah, there was actually, we went to a party, a cast party that we had on Monday, and we watched the movie and played the game.
Ah, well, that's good training, Jen.
Well, yeah, they did that without me. I was in service. So.
Oh, well, I thought maybe you had assigned that or something, you know.
No, I'm glad they had fun, though.
Get familiar with the game, huh? I know that when I played Clue, as I recall now, I would always try to make sure that it was Colonel Mustard. I had some affinity for that goofball. I don't know why. I'm not sure. We'll take a break. Do we have midday lottery numbers available? They're here, so we'll check them. And we'll be back and talk more with our guests here on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. We'll be back right after this break.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 09. The pick 3, 758, 758. The pick 4, 7064. The pick 5, 91696. The wild ball is 8. The treasure hunt is 9, 16, 18, 24, and 29. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $45,000.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
Butler Transit now provides weekday transportation to and from Pittsburgh for just $5 one way. No worrying about traffic or expensive parking fees. Free Wi-Fi is also available. Park at a convenient park and ride or hop on the bus at the downtown bus terminal. Senior 65 and up, ride free with a senior pass. For more information, visit butlertransit.com.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
Welcome back, good friends. Nice to have you with us. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, everybody's heard about Hamilton, right? The musical smash on Broadway from a couple of years ago, I think it premiered. You still can't get a ticket on Broadway. And now the touring companies are beginning to go around the country, and it's going to be in Pittsburgh, I think, in January. It's very soon, at any rate. So what do you know about Alexander Hamilton? That's the question. Well, it's interesting because there's going to be a talk on Alexander Hamilton coming up at Butler County Community College this weekend. Steve Cicero, who's a former history teacher, retired history teacher, has prepared a program on Alexander Hamilton. So Steve's going to be with us tomorrow and talk a little bit about Alexander and kind of give you a little bit of background, especially those of you who are managed, were able to snare tickets for the show coming up in January. So we look forward to chatting with Steve Cicero on tomorrow's program. And also tomorrow, there is a nationwide organization called Our Revolution, and they are campaigning for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And we'll talk about that and why they think it's important. Dane Winkler from the local branch of Our Revolution will be with us tomorrow. Okay, still a program note. We're chatting today with three students from Nauk High School. They're cast members of Clue on Stage. It's the fall play that's going to be on stage at Nauk High School this weekend. And Jen Bronder, you said Friday and Saturday, is that right?
Yes, Friday and Saturday, 7:30. Tickets at www.showtix4u.com or at the box office. You can get them at the door.
Mm-hmm. What's the web address again for online?
Sure. www.showtix4u.com.
Mm-hmm. Or at the box office, right?
Or the box office. You can come to the school probably around 6 o'clock on Friday and Saturday evening. We'll start selling tickets.
No, I don't. I've been to so many high schools, I can't remember whether I've been in the auditorium at Nauk. Is it a pretty big auditorium?
It is. It seats about 600. We'd love to see it all full.
No.
So.
Well, I hope it gets full, yeah. Jen is also a faculty member at Nauk High School, in addition to directing the fall play and the school musical, which is in the spring, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Have you announced what that's going to be yet?
No, November 27th, we'll have our meeting with the students and announce it.
I see. So. And do you have auditions before the holiday break, or do you do that after Christmas and New Year's?
Yeah, December 1st are the auditions, and we'll do a script read-through right before the holiday break. And then when we get back in January, we're back to work.
Hard at it, huh?
Yes.
We mentioned that Jen is also on the faculty at Nock High School, and I wouldn't have known this except I asked her during the break. What do you teach?
Writing and speech, screenwriting, and several theater courses there.
I think that's just marvelous that these are courses that are offered at Nock High School. Screenwriting. Goodness sakes. You know, in most places, that's an undergraduate course when you get into college. Yeah.
Yeah, it's my first year teaching it. Ms. Thompson had it a couple years before I did, and it's really been a wonderful course to teach. And the kids are such great writers. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to
work there's Amelia
them.
There. Mm-hmm. She's a budding writer, loves
Absolutely.
It. Yeah. You know, I talk to a lot of kids. Some of them are pretty good students, and they hate writing. You know, I hate writing. I don't like to do it. And they also, there's a theater course at Nock?
Theater 1, Theater 2, and Performing Arts, which is essentially musical theater history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some years a college and high school theater class, if we can get enough students to sign up for it.
Wonderful opportunity for the students at Nock.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you also teach a writing class, huh?
Writing and speech, yeah, and the screenwriting. Yeah. And next year we'll add in film, so I'm going to be very busy.
Wow. That's terrific. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. Clue on stage. Did all of you guys know each other before you were cast in the show?
Yeah. We all
did the show last year together, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about the student population at Nock. What, 300-400, something like that?
It's about 800.
800?
860, something like that.
Well, when you get school that big, sometimes you don't know everybody, you know? Mackenzie, have you done theater before? Is this your first time on stage?
I used to do a lot of theater when I was younger, but I started getting back into theater last year with the fall play.
Mm-hmm. I'm amazed that you're able to do theater and still maintain that grade point average. Good for you. You must have good study habits.
Thank you.
Either that or you know how to budget your time better than I do, that's for sure. And what about you, Amelia Lyon? Have you done a lot of theater?
I've had an interest in it since like sixth grade, but I think I really got serious about it whenever I came to Nock. I did my first show with Ms. Bronder my freshman year, and I've been doing it ever since.
Mm-hmm. You didn't go to South Butler as an elementary student? You were somewhere else?
No, I went to St. Luke's before I came here.
Down in Cabot, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you want to be a writer, and now you're interested in theater. You got to start writing plays.
I've thought about it.
Yeah. Give that a try anyway. Who knows? Might be your hidden talent.
Yeah.
What about you, Sam? You do theater before?
I did fall play last year, and that was my first show.
Mm-hmm. I think that it is so beneficial for students at the high school level to be involved in theater, even if it's just one play. And if you can do several of them during your high school career, all the better. It gives these students the realization that they can get up in front of people, in front of the public, and perform. And that's so critical in this day and age for later in your career. You got to be able to speak in front of people, right? No matter what your job is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And even tougher to stand up and perform in front of your peers. You know, it's one thing to stand up in front of a bunch of people you don't know, but then you look at your classmates there. Wow, can I do this? The answer is yes, you can do it. Well, it looks like you've had a lot of fun putting this show together. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. And who knows? Is it Professor Plum, Colonel Mustard, or Miss Scarlet? Or all of them? I do not know. Clue on stage at Nock High School. Jen, give us the particulars again, the dates this weekend.
Sure. This weekend, Friday and Saturday evening, 7:30. Tickets at showtixforyou.com. Or at the box office at Nock High School starting at 6 o'clock.
How much are tickets?
$5.
Wow. Mm-hmm. How are you going to beat that price for an evening of entertainment, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
And do keep in mind, even though, you know, there are, this is about murders, it's a comedy, it's a farce, and for older kids it would still be appropriate, right?
Oh, yeah, all of them. The murders are very cartoonish.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't anything that is graphic in any way.
Well, I thought we should mention that because
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Today's day and age, parents might want to know that. This is all great fun. Madcap fun, for goodness sakes. That's what a farce is all about. Thank you, Mackenzie Mead. Thank you, Amelia Lyon. Thank you, Sam Thinnes, for being with us here today. I hope, for heaven's sakes, I didn't take you out of trigonometry class.
No.
Or maybe that would be a good thing. I don't know. Well, good luck. Break a leg for your show.
Thank you so much.
And Jen, thanks for bringing the kids in. That's terrific. Nice to meet them. Nice to have them here. Okay, about time for us to check news. In fact, it is time for us to check news. Thanks for being with us today, and hope to see you tomorrow, 12:30, for the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR 680 in Butler.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has just left the building.
This is WISR Butler.